Can't Stop the Serenity 2009, worldwide charity screenings for equality now. Joss Whedon's Serenity is on the big screen again to benefit his favorite charity, Equality Now. We've raised over $250,000 since 2006, but we need your help again. Also featuring the theatrical debut of Dr. Horrible's Sing-Along Blog. Visit CantStopTheSerenity.com to find a local screening near you.
It was the year of deep geeking.
The year of Feedbackapalooza.
The year we discussed our favorite show.
It was the year without Zima.
The year of great tequila.
The year of puns.
And a year of more interviews.
It was a new chance for fun.
It was the end of the series.
It was the year we made it to Crusade.
The year is 2009. The show, Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And God help us all, this is Joe Straczynski.
Yes, people, we have done it. The great maker himself said yes and is now on the show with us.
Stop sending those emails.
Breathe. We're good. So thank you very much, Joe, for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I always kind of wanted to let this as an opportunity for all the other people involved in the show and the creative folks and the directors and the crew to have a chance to come out and have a moment in the sun. So I've sort of been aware of the show for some time now and keeping an eye on it, but I really kind of wanted it to go its way for a while with everyone else, and now I figured now it's time to come out of the woodwork and say hello.
Well, good. We're glad you did. So that leads to our first question for you. Obviously, like you just said, you kind of keep tabs on us.
Me and my lawyers.
Good, very good. So how much eye rolling do you or your lawyers display when you hear us geeking about your writing?
It's always surreal. It's like hearing about somebody else. It's a Woody Allen moment when you hear someone talking about a piece of work and you think, is that right or is that wrong or is that would I agree with that? So it's always interesting, and I often acquire perspectives on a work that I might not have had otherwise. So there are times I have to sort of bail out after a while because seeing your own work discussed after a while can become weird, and you become kind of fascinated by hearing, yeah, I'm cool, aren't I? You know, and they think, no, stop it, keep yourself in line. You know, you get up and look like a geek in the morning in the mirror every day, go back to work.
So you haven't heard us talk about season 5 yet much, have you?
I haven't, just I've been buried in work.
Good.
No, I like season 5. Come on now.
Well, we like it, but we complain about it. But that's okay.
Yeah, look, it was an uneven season. I'm the first one to admit that. Also probably the second and third to admit that. And we had a lot to overcome going into that season. And it took a while to find its balance, and it didn't go the way I planned for it to go. Lord knows. certain elements that I'd been counting on weren't there suddenly, including people I'd been counting on that weren't there. And a lot of it just got kicked in the shin. So, you know, I look at it as flawed as well. The second, third, and fourth seasons, I think, are pretty solid. First and the fifth, there's a bit of struggling there.
Well, Joe, this is I've made this comment on some previous episodes here, but the thing that I really like best about the fifth season, it shows what happens after Happily Ever After.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, that is as fascinating as anything else. You know, too often what happens is in science fiction's stories and movies and books is they defeat whatever menace it is, and then everybody hugs, shakes hands, and roll credits. And while, you know, it's well documented that you've wrapped up the arc as best you could with year 4 and then suddenly found yourself with year 5, I think somehow the overall epic is stronger for it.
In some ways, I tend to agree. The thing about B5 is that I always want to talk about consequences, which is why, for instance, in Severed Dreams, we could have ended on a high note of triumph, but I wanted to go down below decks and show the human cost. You know, ending on a happy, jingoistically one moment would be the simplest thing in the world, but I chose not to do that. And I always looked at the five seasons as paralleling the five steps in a novel. Introduction, rising action, complication, climax, and denouement. So the fifth year would be about those consequences. It just said those consequences would have been cleaner had I had all the tools that I had planned to have. But you're correct in that consequences, to me, are what the story is all about. Choices, yeah, and consequences.
So I have a curious question about something from season two. Do you remember mentioning that Doug Netter would get back at you for incorporating Netter's syndrome?
Yes.
Did he ever make good on that?
He knew better. Yeah, huh. Understand, I come from Russian stock, and we hold a grudge. And we have perfected the art of revenge. So he may have mouthed off about the fact that he was terribly offended, but it's been the point of fact he had a good time with it, and all was fine. And the fact that he is still alive proves that there is no power at all to voodoo.
Nice. All right, well, when we first opened, and you mentioned you've been very busy, so this is my personal question. What do I have to do to get you to drop everything you're doing and get the Lensman screenplay finished?
Well, the second draft is in.
Hey, yay!
Oh, yeah, and everyone's very happy with it, and we'll now see where that goes. But I'm very pleased with it. I think it really does create that world, and what's cool about it, in addition to all the character stuff that's in there now, is just the sheer scope and scale of it, which is what the Doc Smith books were always about to me to a large extent, and it was the scale was insane. And we found ways to really dramatize that. Case in point, it's a very small example from the script, and take this as being emblematic of the scale of the whole thing. You've got these two fleets battling it out, which we've seen 100 times before.
Sure.
But now, within that massive fleet battle, you have two ships locked on with gravity lancets firing at each other. They're linked together like scorpions in a bottle tied with a string, you know, by the gravity beams. Inside that, you have the crew of one ship in EVA suits with armor coming out to try and board the other ship. They send their people out to stop them. So they have hand-to-hand combat between
two ships. With space axes and all that.
Yeah, it's freaking huge.
Yeah.
And we're looking to do new things with effect. And of course, with Ron Howard involved, it's always going to be character-oriented. So when you combine what you can do with effects these days with a really strong character story, I think it's pretty cool.
Well, I've been a longtime Lensman fan, and that was one of the things. When I first saw Kosh in Midnight on the Firing Line, my first response was a cheer, and hey, there's Nadrick's cousin.
Not so much intended, but the notion of it was certainly there, I'm sure. And what's fun for me is I've always been a fan, and which is why, you know, my quotes are on the back of the book, the most current edition. And actually, the way that the assignment came about was I got a call from Jim Whittaker at Imagine, who was one of the producers on Changeling. And he said, I want to read you something. Tell me if you agree with this still. And he begins reading me my own quote. I said, do you still agree with this? I said, absolutely. It's one of the best space sagas ever told. We're going to buy it for you. Really?
Nice.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they bought it.
I'm really looking forward to it. Like I said, I'm a longtime Lensman fan. I cut my teeth on that, so.
We'll get those fixed.
Nah, too late for it.
All right.
And, so speaking of...
I have right now is that there's so much of what I'm doing, I can't talk about. There's two major movies that I'm writing that have not been announced anywhere, and because they're top secret, and they're taking most of my time. But I hope that sometime in July, August, they'll let me, you know, announce these things, because they're both massively cool projects.
Cool. Looking
awesome.
Forward to that.
Yeah.
So speaking of selling things, going back to before the beginning, how did you sell Doug Netter on the concept of Babylon 5?
He came on pretty fast. I mean, we had worked on Captain Power, for which I'm still doing penance. and I wrote up a treatment on it, showed it to him after I left, and he liked it a great deal, saw the commercial potential for it, and said, I know, Joe, you can't just go out there and sell a treatment. You got to write a pilot. I know, Doug. I work in television for a while. Yeah, but you know, you got to write a script. I know, Doug. Thank you very much. Can you write a script? I can write a script. So I wrote the pilot, and he, you know, commissioned some artwork and stuff from Peter Ledger, and we started taking off, and took 5 years to find someone who believed in the project outside of ourselves.
Now, if Doug had not bought into B5, what would you have done?
Found somewhere else. Yeah, I from the moment I first came up with the notion, I believed that there was something important here. And I am noted for being very stubborn. And I don't take no for an answer. So had Doug said, nah, get out of here. It would, and to know Doug is to do Doug, by the way. Everyone who knows Doug does an imitation of it. it's like talking to a pirate. You know, all he needs is, you know, a pirate on his shoulder and boarding the building next door. I would have gone somewhere else because I believed in it down to my socks and still do. And nothing would have stopped it. I think there are some things that are part of the zeitgeist, some things that their time has come. And I think that the time for B5 had come, and nothing was going to stop it.
Well, in the process of shopping the series, everybody knows the story about you approaching Paramount, but what, knowing that they had Star Trek, why go to Paramount? Why bring them another space opera type story?
Well, the thought at the time was because they had that corner of the science fiction universe covered, that they might be the best place to go. Also, they were trying to put together their own network at the time, and they had a good lock on syndication. And they were the big guns. You always go to the big guns first. And they were doing other shows beyond Star Trek, you know, for syndication, and they just seemed like the likely choice. And gave them the material, everything. I mean, the treatment, the pilot script, the artwork, all that stuff. They were interested in, fact, they mentioned that the two guys who were in their a new show for them were going to be up at a big TV exhibition thing in San Francisco, and they were going to be able to look at some of this themselves to get some, you know, suggestions or just to look at it in general. And they first came back being very interested, and suddenly out of nowhere said, no, we're going to pass, which surprises because we really had a letter of interest from them that they were very interested in pursuing it. And, well, we figured that's that. We went off and brought it elsewhere, and we're kind of surprised when we saw another show come up, sit on a space station with a gambling area and casinos and a bar and ambassadors and trades going on, and that there had never been a show like that in the preceding 60 years of television. To have two suddenly come out at the same time seemed curious to us.
So given that... how much credence do you put into the fan urban legend that Paramount wholly ripped off B5, just kept the property long enough to get all their notes in straight, and then said no and went and made their own stuff from your notes?
Well, I put it in two terms. First off, again, like I said, you can look at the two starting points side by side. Male captain, female second in command, a big casino-like area, bars, ambassadors trading on a space station, which had a shapeshifter in its pilot. It's kind of hard not to see a corollary there. I was in my office one day, and Peter Jurasik came in and said, do you know, and he mentioned one of the cast members from Space Nine. And I said, I'm familiar with him. I don't know him personally, but I know this person. He said, well, he wanted me to, I saw him at a party last night. He wanted me to give you a message. I said, okay, other than screw you, what's the message? And he said, we know that our show came from your show, and we wish you all the luck.
Really?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And those are the only two points I think are worth making.
Wow.
We'll say that I had discussed legal action with Warner Brothers, but they were concerned that if we did that, both shows would end up in litigation and neither show would get anywhere. So they overruled that, and I could not proceed without them, so that was the end of that.
Well, given your knowledge, your breadth of experience with Warner Brothers, what are your thoughts on how B5 might have turned out if Paramount had picked it up and run with it?
There's no way of knowing. I do think that Paramount, to their credit, has a better understanding of how to run a franchise. And their divisions at Paramount, television, film, video, are all synergistic. They all work together at Paramount. And if one division sees another one has a good show or a good movie, they'll feed off of that into something else. So that they're constantly promoting each other, for lack of a better term. And a franchise can rise to the surface more quickly. Warner Brothers, God love them, was built on a different model. Their model is that every division competes with every other division. So, for instance, home video doesn't want to help out television if it costs home video money that they don't get back immediately. And television has no interest in helping out home video or feature films because they don't get, you know, it doesn't work out. Money comes out of their budget and they can't get it back again. So the theory was they'd all compete with each other and make for a more aggressive studio. What the actual result is a more dysfunctional studio. And Babylon 5 had the disadvantage of being caught in the switches between home video, and which was then sort of starting off and was keeping an eye on us, and syndication, and the new network, PTEN network, which was different from syndication. And syndication didn't want the Prime Time Network to succeed. And Prime Network wanted to absorb syndication, so they were fighting with each other, which is why apparently B5 has to turn up in syndication since then, because the syndication market didn't care for the fact of where it came from.
That's insane. That's completely insane.
On top of which is why most of the P10 shows are not available anywhere, on top of which, Babylon 5 was not an in-house Warner's project. It was, I guess you could say, an outhouse Warner Brothers project. And they were always kind of looking askance at it. For a show to really kick in, as Star Trek did, it needs to enter syndication. What's happened in the years since B5 went off the air is that it's been looked at as a way for Warners to sort of bring in new platforms. So, for instance, they know that the B5 fans will come in for iTunes, they'll come in for BitTorrent, they'll come in for, you know, Hulu or whatever else is out there, and they use it to support those platforms. But they haven't put it out there on television to bring in a new audience. I think there's still that sort of bad taste in the mouth in the syndication people based on its origins in P10, which we also don't see the David Carradine show or the Time Track show in syndication. They're just not there. Whereas Star Trek, as we know, it may not have succeeded on television in its network incarnation. But by putting it in syndication where new viewers could find it on a regular basis, it found its audience. The audience grew over time. And soon enough, you had something they could build on. I think if B5 were put into syndication, you would, again, build that audience. But because it hasn't, and you've only been relying on the DVDs and the netcast, its audience has either stayed the same or it may have actually even eroded over time because of the fact that, you know, it's just not being supported in the open marketplace where folks can stumble across it while channel surfing.
So related to that, in terms
Paramount
of...
Paramount better at that.
<That's the one>. Right.
They're good at that.
So, regarding that, in terms of the merchandising of Babylon 5, were there any ways in which Warner Brothers met your expectations, and were there places where the merchandising aspect of it fell short? And we're talking, you know, the tie-in books and pins and T-shirts and all that.
Yeah. Again, you're stuck with the hierarchical structure of Warner Brothers. They can invest a lot of time, for instance, making a merchandising deal for Babylon 5 and make, you know, $1 million. or taking the best of the same amount of time and effort in Friends and a merchandising deal and make $100 million. And each department is evaluated by what percentage more profit that division earned this year than last year. So the motivation is always there to focus on those properties that will bring them the most return. B5 was always a question mark to them, and therefore they didn't really explore it. It was sort of put their finger in, and whatever they put out there vanished. I mean, whatever the marketing was, the merchandising was, if they made it, people showed up and they bought it and it disappeared. And they'll say, well, that's a one-off. And then they go back to selling Friends and everything else. Which, again, given their corporate model, you can understand, because they every division at Warner Brothers must show each year a 17% increase over the last year. That's
what?
Their mandate. And therefore, you put in all of your time to the higher profile properties, whereas Paramount doesn't have that same rule, so they can take more time to bring up, you know, a property and create a marketing profile to it, and not to worry about losing valuable time.
Wow.
Yeah, this explains a lot, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, the scariness.
I mean, on one level, creatively, Warner's was great to work with. After episode two of year two, they left us alone. But as a corporate mechanism where you should have all the different divisions working together to create something that they will all profit from, it's almost in their vested interest to not help out a different division so that they show more profit than the other guys did, as opposed to a studio where it's all synergistic. So I love the fact that creatively, Warner's is very supportive of its people and always has been. But when you get into the internecine warfare between the divisions, it ends up hurting itself more than anything else.
Wow.
Yeah.
So to dovetail off of that, you just mentioned that after episode two, season two, Warner's left you alone. So was there any script approval things that you had to go through with Warner still? And how did that change once the switch to TNT was made?
The studio always had to get outlines and when there were any outlines and first drafts and subsequent revisions. And in the first year, they kind of kept an eye on it, and they would have more questions because it was still, and rightly so, because the show was still kind of finding its voice and finding its footing. And I had never run a show before, so I had my own learning curve to deal with, and they were helpful in that respect. But after the first year, when we brought the show in under budget, and the show had been successful, because the rule was that all the P10 shows had to show a profit the year that they were on the air. They couldn't wait for syndication down the road. It had to show profit that year. And we did that. The ratings were good. We succeeded. And by virtue of the fact that we were fiscally responsible, from that point on, they began to say, okay, you know what you're doing. Just send us the stuff. We'll read it. You know, if we have any questions, we'll ask you, but you're pretty much on your own now. And there were a few cases here and there when they had like a question that they would raise, or I would get a call from Greg Mayday at Warner's, was always very supportive of it. Like, for instance, the script came in for one of our episodes, and he called me up and said, let me get this straight. You're saying that Londo is cheating at cards by using his genitals. I said, yes, that is correct. We don't nail it, as it were, but that's the gist of it. And there was this long pause, and here's what we're going to do. I'm going to pretend I didn't read it. You're going to pretend you didn't write it, and we'll all get along just fine. So those are the kind of calls we would get.
So how did that change once TNT got involved?
TNT was, for the last year, B5 was actually pretty much fine. They knew that they didn't know the show, and they knew that we did, and they knew that we were used to having our way. So they didn't really get much involved. I mean, our two network liaisons were very friendly and very helpful. They just sort of let us do what we had been doing. You know, I can't recall specifically any notes that they gave. They may have, but I don't recall what they were or if they made a difference in anything. Warner's policy toward us was, you know, benign neglect, which I was perfectly happy with. So it didn't really change. Things only changed in the Crusade ramp-up, which is a whole different story. But for the first year, I was eminently happy with TNT.
Well, going from that, talking about the changes between the first season and the second season, how did your relationship with you and Doug Netter and Richard Compton, the synergy you built up there, how did that change when Richard Compton left and John Copeland was brought on board? Did that change the creative process, the creative flow much? Or
John was always there. John was there from the get-go, from the very, very earliest stages when I first brought it to Doug, because he worked at Cap'n Power. And so John had been with us from the early inception of the concept. And it was John who sort of brought in Ron Thornton, as a matter of fact, to talk about doing CGI.
Mm-hmm.
So John really had more of a day-to-day impact on the show than Richard Compton did, who was the director and John was the line producer. And there was some creative differences between myself and Richard over time that kind of developed. And after a while, we sort of felt best to go our separate ways, and I could then focus on the show as I wanted it to be. So he didn't have much of an impact outside of the shows that Richard himself worked on. Whereas John was my right hand on Babylon 5. We had some conflicts later on, but the simple truth of the matter is that I could not have made that show or made it as well as it was made had Copeland not been there. There are some people who you turn to and say, I need X taken care of in the next 20 minutes, and it has to be done. And it's something massive and horrific. And he would get it done. He was always a stable hand on the production. He kept a tight rein on the budget. He kept the different departments in line. And we were a team. He was in every edit with me, side by side. Oftentimes, I was still new to editing. People forget that was my first time running a show, and it was first time I was ever in an editing room, first time I was ever dealing with special effects or composition or anything else. And John had come from working on action shows, so for the first couple of seasons, when we got to the action pieces, I would do the broad strokes on the editing, where I would say, okay, this is what I want to do, and I would lay out the scenes. It wouldn't be fast enough pace. Then I would turn to John and say, Captain Action, go at it. And John would go in there and tighten it up, and I would sort of watch him. And between the two of us, John learned from me how to tell a story in some respects through editing, and I picked up some of his tricks on action editing. So he was instrumental from the first day to the last day.
Now, as far as the other writers who got to write for the show, we know you had relationships with DiTilio and Ellison and Gaiman. So what was the criteria or the decision process for selecting those other writers that wrote for the show?
It was a combination of different elements. I mean, when you work on a show, the key thing you need is someone who can deliver. So I looked around to those who I knew and who I knew could deliver. Because the last thing you want is to have the first day of filming arrive and you don't have a script. That's bad. To keep the show on budget and be able to produce it sensibly, we had to have all of our scripts done as far in advance as possible. We never had less than three or four scripts ahead locked and finished, whereas a lot of shows you will tend to see pages of writing while you're shooting. While shooting on Jeremiah, they were shooting another show just down the street from us, and I just felt so bad for them because oftentimes they would rehearse a scene or block a scene by moving people around a room without having a script in hand. We know the scene's going to happen here. We know we're going to talk about this subject. We haven't got the pages yet, but we're going to sort of block out the camera so when the pages arrive and we memorize them, then we'll know what to do. I didn't want to do that. So I went out and got those writers who I knew could deliver. Larry DiTilio, David Gerald, DC Fontana, also people whose work I respected from other forms. It didn't hurt that they had the Trek cachet to bring with them. And I just needed to know that there were writers who would listen, writers who could deliver, and writers whose work I respected. Those were the criteria. And in the science fiction arena, there's a very shallow pool of that. There are a lot of good writers who may take forever to deliver for you, and there's a lot of not so great writers who can deliver fast, and you have a very small number who can deliver fast and really well. And I sort of targeted that subsection and was rewarded by that with some really good stories.
So with other changes, how much of a shakeup was there between season one and season two with all the different changes and, you know, production changes, cast changes, changes in the CGI group? What did you have to shift around to get everybody back on the same page?
It wasn't that much. The largest change, was, of course, was changing out Michael for Bruce. But the rest of the team adapted pretty fast. I have to be honest and say that we really did have an extraordinary crew, an extraordinary cast, and there weren't that many changes in CGI. We were still working with Ron's company. It was a solid crew, so, and everyone was very welcoming to Bruce when he arrived on the set. So there wasn't that much really to overcome.
Okay, what was the moment of realization when you realized that Michael O'Hare had to be let go, and how did that proceed?
There was a slow process of Michael and I talking about it and realizing that I put all my rhetorical eggs in one basket. And Michael had come to us from a stage background, some television, and he never was 100% comfortable with playing the captain, the guy in charge of everything. He was always more of a, you know, different kind of a character. End of the season, we just sort of had a long conversation about it, and, you know, I came to the decision that we should part ways but catch up down the road. And he was fine with that. I mean, you know, we actually remained, you know, good friends, and there really was no friction. There was no animosity. There was no nothing. And when years later I said, "Do you want to come back for this two-parter we're doing?" He said, "Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to do it." So we came back and we had a good time. So it was just one of those things where it seemed very natural to do it. And was there a certain risk involved? Sure. And the moment we notified Warners of what we were going to do, of course, they said, "We'll bring in a star, bring in someone, you know, with the real name value." And we took that as you know, license to go out there and do whoever else we really wanted. And Doug had worked with Bruce previously, and in talking to me about it, said Bruce is really good, and we'll respect the text, and we'll try and bend it to become a star vehicle for him. He's a good, hardworking, talented actor who respects the words, which is what I wanted to hear. So we met with Bruce, and after he left the room, I said to John and to Doug, "That's him. That's the guy. Now what's that?"
Now, given that complaints about CGI have been I'm going to say the flag that the detractors of the series waved constantly in the faces of us fans, what led to, I guess, letting Foundation go and establishing Netter Digital?
Can we complain after Netter came on?
Well, just what led to that change?
Well, after the change was a number of things, but during the course of the show, we had very few complaints about the CGI. In fact, people seemed to really embrace it. And we had more effects than any other show on the air. What led to the changeover, after helping Ron to establish Foundation Imaging, they really began to grow, which, you know, they're a bunch of talented guys, which makes perfect sense that they would grow. The demand on them became extensive from other shows. They began doing Star Trek, and which at first had said, "We'll never do CGI." All of a sudden, they not only began doing CGI, they made our CGI. And the impression that we got was that they were filtering the work down to, like, initial first-time year one CGI guys rather than more experienced guys we had been working with before. And we said to them, you know, we can't have guys who are still learning the craft doing the effects. We're in, you know, the latter part of a show. We need to keep quality level up. And we had some back and forth and back and forth, and Doug and John, and to some degree there was, and I didn't think about it at the time as much as I should have, but there was probably some degree of conflict of interest there. I said, "Look, you know, we can always establish our own company and do our own effects ourselves." I said, "If we're going to do that, I can't be part of it because then I have a conflict of interest on my own part. I wasn't thinking of anybody else. And if you're going to do it, I can't own it. I have to make the decision if we're going to change effects companies with what Balasag said was clean hands and composure. You know, I have to be sure that I'm doing it for the right reason and not out of some enlightened self-interest. So they said, well, let's put together a team and see what we can do. And when they came back, said, yes, we can take it over. We can do this and maintain the level of quality that we're used to. And I said, okay, then I'll authorize the switch. But it was less being dissatisfied with the work because they did great work. It was just that realizing that coming into the next couple of years, we were going to be getting third and fourth tier people. That's how it was represented to me in any event. And we really couldn't afford to have that happen.
Okay, so you don't think the viewers lost something or gained something in that? Because I have had, in I guess not recent years, but in previous years, I'd had arguments with other sci-fi fans, and their contention was that the CGI was not up to snuff for the time, and I was always flabbergasted by that. So you've never heard that argument?
Maybe I've been sheltered from it, but no, because here's the thing of it. We were the first show to do CGI in this level for television, and there weren't many other shows that were doing this kind of level of CGI. I mean, we had oftentimes hundreds of shots in a single episode, and they were all ambitious shots. It was never just like one white, pale ship passing through frame. You know, massive battles, you know?
Yeah.
What they would be comparing against, I don't know. You can argue that point now. What we can do with the present, but at that time, no, I wasn't aware of any of that.
Well, the what I heard at the time was more the detractors saying, "Well, look at what Star Trek's doing over there with practical models." And my response is, "Sure, Star Trek's got $3 million to drop on a shot."
And Star Trek, their effects were always very conservative. We were out there on the edge, dancing what you can and can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also correct. I think the budget of Trek DS9 was something between $2.5 and $3 million an episode. And we were making this show for about $900,000 an episode.
Okay.
And despite that, we still had more CG than they did per episode and more ambitious CG than they did per episode. Even after they got Foundation Imaging and I was over there, I would hear from their guys sometimes saying, you know, they're always handcuffing us. We like to do this really cool, ambitious shot, but they always bring it down to the most simple level because they're afraid of breaking the Enterprise.
Wow. I'm just amazed that you never heard that argument before. But yeah, it's easy to say models look better back then, but eh. Enough for the argument. I do have one more question about the characters, you know, as they developed over the five seasons. Was there a conscious choice to give the ambassadors assistants instead of, you know, spouses or mates on the show?
Yeah, because you could do more with an assistant. You could not, for instance, if you're Londo... turn to your wife and say, you take my place on the council today. Well, I do this. You can do that with an assistant or sort of sub-level ambassador. And that allowed me to have a Centauri presence in two places at the same time. And to have two different points of view being represented. A spouse, male or female, would be limited to what they could do. And I had considered it at one point, and I sort of laying out, okay, what can I do with this character if I do bring that on? It was a very small box. And I thought, well, look, also this is, for lack of a better term, a military base. And what you tend to see in a military base is, you know, people who may be married, but their spouses aren't there. You can walk on to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and you'll see a lot of people there, male and female, but you won't see their spouses. Same thing when you're working at an airport. You will tend to see, you know, the people who work there, but not their spouses. And this is a cross between an airport and a military base. So it just seemed the question of a form follows function, the broadest story opportunities, and what seemed to make the most amount of sense, given that we had a small budget to work with. I mean, if I had brought in, say, for instance, Londo's wife or wives, I still would have had to have an assistant for him to achieve what I wanted story-wise. So we would have to bring in one, two, or three other characters that we really couldn't support by the budget. We as it was, we had to have three different tiers of cast. There were those actors who we had for 22 out of 22. There were other actors we made deals with for, I think it was like 18 out of 22, and some were 11 out of 22. And I had to sort of have this flow chart in my office to say, yeah, I've now used this actor X number of times. I can't use him more for a while and save it toward the end. And I had to weave the stories around who would be available to me. Because when you're working on a very limited budget, you have to incorporate those things. I mean, half of the show was creativity, half of it was math. And working around that was always problematic. But in the end, I think it actually helped the creativity a bit.
Now, regarding all those characters that you were trying to balance through all that, we noticed that none of the main characters had a solid, happy personal relationships until you reached season 5. Was that a conscious choice on your part, or was that something that just developed from where the characters were?
I think it's a combination of elements. I wanted to start off, certainly, with everyone in conflict to one degree or another, and that tends to lead toward unhappy personal lives. And Jakar certainly could not have a happy personal life until he reached the point of transformation, which didn't happen until much later on. And because he and Londo are mirror images of each other, while they were both being antagonistic, neither could have any peace. When Jakar finally turned and was elevated, he created a space where Londo could follow. So they could now begin to have a happy personal life. After we've come through the crisis of the war and Sheridan has achieved something of value, then he can, too, have a personal life. There's that arc of building towards something, and it's not just about the wars and the politics. It's about finding that part of your soul which you can bring up and elevate and achieve some measure of happiness. So it's through all the strife and crisis of Babylon 5, a lot of these characters can reach a point where they can be happy finally. Because each of them, or most of them, took that moment to stand on their courage and say what they believed in. And I think that it's when you are willing to take a chance, when you're willing to say what you believe and stand on it and plant your feet, face the wind, that you create a position where you can become an elevated human being and achieve happiness. And those who did that achieved that. Those who did not, did not.
Now, speaking of taking chances, in your MIT lecture, you classified Crusade as a failure. Okay, but we get lots of response here at the podcast about people who really loved the show and still hunger for more. So can you elaborate on what ways you think that Crusade failed the fans?
There's a misnomer in what was said, and there's a transcript being prepared now that will actually say what I said in the DVD, that'll clarify it as well. Cool. It wasn't that Crusade was a failure, and I don't consider it to be a failure. There's two parts to this. One is the motivation for going into Crusade, and one is what happened to Crusade. My intention of going into Babylon 5 was to do a 5-year story and get out. And what happened, when you have 5 years of guaranteed employment, and when you're a writer in this town, jobs are often hard to come by. I was very lucky. I had at that point worked 15 years without a break, pretty much, in television. But as you come to the end of the show, there's a sense of, number one, what if I go out there and I can't find anything else? But number two, you have this crew and this cast and people around you who are depending on you. For 5 years, this crew had a good show and a life, and they didn't want to see it blown away. And to a certain part of my personal responsibility here was the fear of failure, of going out somewhere else, or the fear of not getting a job, or the fear of disappointing all these different people. And that, okay, well, I will stay and do this other show. Now, having said that, was Crusade a good show? Yes, it was. Could we have told good stories in that show? Were we telling good stories in that show? The answer is yes. So I, creatively, that show was not a failure to me, and I need to be very clear about that, because there were good stories to be told. It was, number one, my personal motivation for going into it, which was, you know, to stay in a universe that I loved. And I think if you're to be sincere as a writer, you have to be willing to kill your own children. And for me, that should have been cueing to what I thought to in the first place, 5 years out and walk away from that universe. Now, not having done that, we made a good show. The problem with Crusade was that we walked into a situation where we ended up getting bitten in the ass. After they commissioned Crusade, and had we done the whole show, it would have been remarkable. That show was going to go places that you have no idea.
That's right. Keep teasing me.
Well, when you end the first season with your main character, his soul being placed inside the apocalypse box, which is what was going to happen to save his life, it gets even stranger from there. But anyway.
See, that's why we want more. Uh-huh. I think we all realize that it's like with Babylon 5, we saw you use the epic, that 5-year arc, and we just knew that Crusade was going to take that in amazing places. It was like, now that you got the warm-up over with, Crusade was going to be the one that was going to blow us all away.
Oh, yeah, look, I mean, the story would have really been about them going up against the establishment and then uncovering secrets and transforming the shape of Earth politics and our role in the universe in a huge way. The Drock play was only a way to get the story started. That would have been, we actually would have found a cure in the second year, which would have told you that there was a lot more to go with this thing. They would have ended up renegades, rogues, not that dissimilar from Blake 7.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that structure. The problem was, and we were doing fine, we had very few notes in TNT, they were doing great, now all of a sudden, and I didn't hear about this until much, much later, they did an internal rating survey of their audience, and they discovered that, and they couldn't do this until they had B5 on for about a year, that audience members would show up for B5. The TNT audience would leave. B5 audience showed up. And they left and didn't stick around for the next show, and the TNT audience came back again. And it wasn't adding anything to them, and their core audience didn't really want science fiction. And they realized this after we were already in production. And when the report came in, it was like the next day that they sort of, you know, said, stop production. We need to figure out what's going on here. We didn't know what was going on. We'd been under the impression everything was fine. And then someone must have said, look, you have to justify why you're going to pull out of the show. And we began getting all these notes that were just horrendous. They were awful. And a real fight started between us and TNT and its leadership at that time. It's a different crew now, so it's a very different environment. But at that time, they were doing everything they could to get out of the contract by saying this wasn't the show we wanted. and that led to some just constant internecine battles between us. And what should have twigged me to the fact that something was going on was in the middle of this whole battle, they dropped many millions of dollars to pick up rerun rights to a very popular cop show. And even in the trade, they said, we don't know where they got this money, because our information was that they had, you know, committed all their funds for the rest of the year. Well, that was the funds for Crusade.
Oh, man.
They were able now to work out the contract to buy this other show with. We didn't know that. None of this was known at the time. It's just after a while, I had guys from TNT come up to me and say, listen, I should tell you what really happened. Here's a memo that I have from so-and-so. This confirms that we were trying to get out of the contract. And it wouldn't matter what you did or didn't do, we would have found some reason to get out of the contract.
Well, so there was absolutely no way to come to a creative compromise that would have saved production because they were so adamant against it? Or would there have been anything you could have done?
No.
Wow.
Absolutely. They said science fiction is not what our audience wants to see. Good, bad, indifferent, it doesn't matter. They wanted the show gone. And when they made the determination that we were heading toward the very end, we went to sci-fi and said, do you want the show? Do we pick up the show? They said, we'd love to pick up the show. All we ask in return is that we can buy the rights to the Babylon 5 reruns, which TNT had at that time, so that we can make a package out of it. So we went back to TNT, which had paid don't know what the amount was, but let's say for now it was a dollar, just for our own purposes and making life easier. Let's say a dollar per episode. And TNT said, well, if you want to buy the rights back for Science Fiction Channel, it's going to cost you $100 per episode.
Holy cow.
And so if I came back and said, we can't make that work. The cost of buying the show is horrendous. We can't. The reason for that was their terror was if some other network got hold of Crusade and it became a hit,
they'd look like idiots.
Exactly, and heads would roll. So they were adamant about the fact that they wouldn't do it and wouldn't let somebody else do it either. It was like a monkey with his hand wound up in the jar, won't let go and can't pull it out. So, and God bless Sci-Fi, they tried as hard as they could. They crunched the numbers, they ran the numbers, they figured different advertising solutions and maybe different ways of running the show, and they couldn't make the money work. And we eventually ran out of time, and that was the end of it.
Yeah, I remember being a little, more than a little miffed when TNT had announced that they had bought the series, because Sci-Fi Channel had been announced that Sci-Fi Channel was considering it, but they passed on it and committed to 3 seasons of First Wave. And after seeing the first 5 episodes of First Wave, I went, what have you guys done?
Yeah.
But going back to Crusade, what was the reasoning behind choosing a different composer for the music, going with Evan Chen instead of Christopher Franke? Was that just trying to create a whole new feel? Was that trying to give TNT a little bit something different?
It was really my decision. And in retrospect, it was, the wrong decision.
Really?
What made Babylon 5 work as well as it did is Christopher Franke and his music. We would sit down with every episode, and he understood from the get-go that, to me, that this was opera, and to create the music as though it were opera. And there was always a richness to his music that you could play with, that you could really get emotionally involved with. And in the mix, when you do all the special effects and the sound effects and the music, I could get into and play with. So, for instance, you're coming into a battle scene, and there's a lot of percussion going on in the music, as well as the sound effects of the explosions, you could, for instance, take out the percussion, and you have the explosions as percussion, where you take out the explosion and have the percussion as explosions. And he gave you all these different stems to play with, and it's just, my mixes are very intricate. They go through sound by sound, note by note, to make these things work. Evans, for one, didn't have that flexibility for me. It was really kind of mono-sounding. That's the only word I can think of at the moment. And it wasn't terribly emotional. It was very cool-sounding at a distance to it. As we just put on a CD and listened to, terrific. But TV and storytelling is about emotion, about making the audience feel something for your characters, the good to succeed, the bad to fail. And his music, as good as it was, to me didn't have that emotional texture to it. And I had gone that route. I wanted something different. I wanted to do something more avant-garde, if you will, more different. And in retrospect, I either should have stayed with Christopher or brought someone on to do music of a more textured and layered form. Again, not to say that it wasn't good music, because it was, and I enjoyed the music on its own terms. But as illustration of moments of character and revelation, for me, it didn't have what it needed to have. By then, we were committed and had to follow through.
Hmm. Yeah, because I am one of the few people who have said publicly many times that I love the soundtrack. But to me, it sounded like it worked for the story, because these were people who found themselves in one particular situation trying to help their world. And in the next season, we're going to find themselves hunted outcasts. So that feeling against the grain, you know, having the music help you put you on edge, I thought that was going to actually fit, because the story was going to move to a place where it could fit with the music. At least that's what I thought.
And you're not wrong. I mean, that was also part of what I felt in terms of the overall arc of the show, it did work for that, but it's on an individual basis. When, you know, oftentimes for it's in the well of forever, other episodes where I thought, God, we really just needed something to just, you know, oftentimes with Chris, I would just, we would sit there going through an episode on the screen and indicating where the music goes in and goes out. And I come to the part that said, Chris, would break my heart. Whatever you put in here, break my heart. And there wasn't much of that in Crusade. The music was illustrative, but not evocative.
Obviously, sure, that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Going back to your interaction with TNT, you had three or four movies that were done specifically for TNT. You had In the Beginning, which was kind of like a the story so far for newbies, and River of Souls and Third Space. What was the driving force to producing those? How much of that was just making product, and how much of it was supporting what you were trying to talk about in the Babylon 5 universe?
When TNT acquired the show, they really wanted to do something that was branded as their own, as opposed to just picking up P10's Aftershocks. And I said, well, if you produce four TV movies for us, two in the first part and two in the latter part, they can brand those as being ours, as separate units from the rest of the show. And so I took that as an opportunity to explore some things I wanted to explore. The very first one, I think, to be written was In the Beginning, because I really wanted to show in one cohesive form how the whole thing tied together. And it was after writing that script that members of the crew and cast, even Doug, came to me and said, now I see the whole thing, how it all sews together. And to me, that was... Of the four, that's my favorite, because that one, I think, is truest to what B5 embodies. The River of Souls episode was fun. It was good. May not have been everything I wanted to be. the Lovecraftian story, I always wanted to do Lovecraft. I'll be perfectly honest about it. And I always wanted to do a Lovecraftian story, but the old ones coming back. So that was me basically being a fanboy. Yeah, I
sure.
want to do this. Yeah. Look, old ones. Yeah. Cthulhu photography.
Easy for you to say.
So that Nyarlathotep is all part of that whole thing, you know. And of course, in Occult Arms being the Bridge to Crusade. So they came from TNT. Again, my movie. It came from TNT. And I just seized on them as opportunities to tell stories that I probably couldn't tell in the course of the series, particularly now in the fifth year. I would have loved to have done a River of Souls episode for the fifth year, but there wasn't room. You know, it would have felt stapled on somehow. So why not pull that out and make it its own thing? Yeah. You know?
Sure. Sure. Well, I liked River of Souls. I thought that one actually, in many respects, worked best as a standalone. And Third Space... while I kind of like the Lovecraftian elements of it, the one thing that bothered me about it was its location in the Babylon 5 timeline. Was there a reason why you placed it at that location?
I just wanted to push it back a little bit. It just seemed like the proper place to put it. The thing about River of Souls, by the way, speaking of placement, about a year or two ago when I was... working with Tracy Scoggins on the DVD, she said she was watching River of Souls recently and remembered that when she was working with Richard Biggs, that of all the people you could have chosen to speak from the other side, you picked Richard. And at the time, he was saying he really feels like, you know, he's reaching out to her from the other side. And losing him afterward was very odd for her for that reason of that episode.
Okay, we have to take a breather. But don't fear. There is plenty, plenty more of this interview to come. Just take a breath. Everybody relax. Get your bearings.
If you ever need
together.
An excuse to come back and listen to the Babylon podcast again on another week, now you have it.
Yeah, we're giving it to you right now.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're just going to take a breath, close it out, and we'll see you next week. BabylonPodcast.com is the website. FarpointForums.com, go for the forums. You want to send in an email about anything, including this interview, it's BabylonPodcast@gmail.com. Yep. Or call in your own voicemail, and the lines will be open. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Dear the Great Maker, talk to us all.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.